Blog Talk Radio.
I am the nation. I was born on July 4th, 1776, and the Declaration of Independence is my birth certificate. The bloodlines of the world run in my veins because I offered freedom to the oppressed. I am many things and many people. I am the nation. I am 200 million living souls and the ghost of millions who have lived and died for me. I am Nathan Hale and Paul Revere. I stood at Lexington and fired the shot heard round the world. I'm Washington, Jefferson, Patrick Henry. I'm John Paul Jones, the Green Mountain Boys, and Davy Crockett. I'm Lee and Abe Lincoln. I remember the Alamo, the Maine, and Pearl Harbor. When freedom called, I answered and stayed until it was over there. I left my heroic dead in Flanders fields and in the steaming jungles of Vietnam. I am the Brooklyn Bridge, the wheatlands of Kansas, and the granite hills of Vermont. I am the coal fields of the Virginias and Pennsylvania, the fertile lands of the West, the Golden Gate and Grand Canyon. I sprawl from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 3 million square miles. I'm more than 3 million farms. I'm forest, field, mountain, and desert. I'm quiet villages, and I'm cities that never sleep. You can look at me and see Ben Franklin walking down the streets of Philadelphia. I'm Babe Ruth in the World Series. I'm 130,000 schools and colleges and 326,000 churches where my people worship God as they please. I'm a ballot dropped in a box. I am an editorial in a newspaper, and I'm a letter to a congressman. I'm Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein. I'm Horace Greeley, Will Rogers, and the Wright brothers. I'm George Washington Carver, Daniel Webster, and Jonas Salk. I'm Walt Whitman, Thomas Paine, Tom Sawyer, and Walt Disney. Yes, I am the nation, and these are the things that I am. I was conceived in freedom, and God willing, in freedom I'll spend the rest of my days. May I possess always the integrity, the courage, and the strength to keep myself unshackled, to remain a citadel of freedom and a beacon of hope to the entire world. I am the nation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Patriot Education. My name is Terry Rowland. I'm your hostess for this evening. And as always, we are brought to you through the good offices of www.patriotfamilies.com, a group of people who understand that every single one of us is this nation. We are this nation, ladies and gentlemen, every single one of us, because, thank God, we live in a constitutional republic in which every man and woman has a voice in how our government runs. We can only lose our freedoms, ladies and gentlemen, if we stifle our voices. Tonight's topic for Patriot Education is self-control versus self-esteem. Our public education system has worked so hard at boosting self-esteem through the free appropriate public education for everyone dicta that it's totally forgotten about or ignored the issue of self-control in the classroom. The number of students that I see in my in-school suspension room who are there because they cannot shut up. They blurt out anything that pops into their heads is phenomenal. Part of it is the internet instant, let me tell you what I did in the bathroom 5 minutes ago generation, as if anybody cares what you did in the bathroom 5 minutes ago, but the children assume that you do because it's important to them. Obviously, it has to be important to everybody else. Unfortunately, this quote-unquote freedom of speech, and oh, believe me, they use that excuse for I can say whatever I want, has devolved into a classroom that more closely resembles a monkey cage, where when the teacher is attempting to teach or explain a concept or talk about some new piece of information that the students are expected to remember, he or she has to spend 20 minutes just calming the class down and getting them to stop interrupting every time he or she actually says anything. Even in my ISS classroom, with very strict rules about raise your hand and be silent until you're called on, I have had to send kids out to the office because they cannot control their own mouth. Self-esteem, ladies and gentlemen, is a wonderful thing, but it is earned, not given. Self-control requires a lifetime of personal management and taking personal responsibility for one's acts, words, and deeds. Instead of teaching our children that adulthood doesn't automatically devolve on you like the gentle rain that droppeth from heaven the minute you turn 18, achieving adulthood is a lifelong quest. To be an adult means to be aware of the effect of your actions and words on those around you, and to make good judgments and choices about what you say, when you say, and to whom you say it. I do not expect my middle school students to have this kind of adult perception, but I do expect them to be beginning to learn it. I expect them to have had some kind of training, either in elementary school or at home, or preferably both, in understanding that you do not blurt out whatever is on your mind in the middle of a lesson. You do not giggle hysterically when someone passes gas in the classroom and thereby disrupt the entire hour so nobody learns anything. Granted, middle school humor is prevalent across the board these days in movies like, I can't think of the title of them because I never watched them, but they're all based on bathroom jokes and sexual innuendo and dumb and dumber type of humorous situations. This kind of entertainment is appealing to 12 to 16-year-olds, but it is not appealing in an adult. I do not expect these children to understand this at this age, but I do expect them to understand the concept of shut up and listen. Very few of them do. When I am talking about something that comes up in a lesson, anything from, what the meaning of a hallmark is and where it derives from, I expect the students to actually close their mouths, open their eyes and their ears, and focus on what I am saying. Some of them do. It's funny, when I'm teaching in a classroom and I'm not relying on PowerPoint presentations or showing a movie, 90% of the time the entire class is focused on me and listening with all of those lovely little preteen ears. I do this show, ladies and gentlemen, and you volunteer to listen to it. You're not captive audience. You can turn it off and go somewhere else and listen to something you like better if you choose. Because you are adults, generally, you have achieved the point at which you can make your own choices and take responsibility for them. If you feel that what I'm saying is not interesting or valuable, you have a perfect right to go somewhere else and do something else instead of being here for this show. And that's the way it should be. That's what freedom of speech is about. It's not about, I can say anything I want, and you better not disagree with me, because then you're being politically incorrect, racist, rude, bullying me, or whatever other tag a 13-year-old progressive mind wants to put on it. But in a classroom, freedom of speech is necessarily curtailed. Because in a classroom, the students are not there to express their opinions. They are there to learn from someone who has more knowledge about the subject they are studying than they do. I have had so many students who fall into the individualized education plan, IEP, special education accommodations classification, who have been basically told from the time they were in first or second grade that they do not have to abide by the courteous manners and conventions of society, that it's okay for them to blurt out whatever they're thinking, giggle hysterically, throw something, because, quote-unquote, they can't help it. They're just having a problem, and so everybody else has to stop and wait until they control the problem, or take them for a walk like a pet puppy dog until they can contain themselves sufficiently so the rest of the class can learn. I believe in providing the opportunity to learn to every child, ladies and gentlemen, no matter what his or her difficulties, skill level, problems, or excellences are. I do believe in a free, appropriate public education. It's just I define appropriate slightly differently than the Federal Department of Education does. I don't see that an appropriate education is bowing to the eccentricities of those with problems and thereby denying everyone else in the class the opportunity to learn. I had 8 kids in my tiny little ISS room off and on the other day. I started off with 6 and had to kick one out because his conception of the purpose of being in school was to argue with me that he didn't have to do work assigned to him by his teacher because he didn't like it. I have an advantage that the teachers in the regular classrooms don't, ladies and gentlemen. It is part of the parameters of my in-school suspension room that the students understand, and they're told, every one of them, the minute they walk in the morning, that this is their opportunity to show that they understand rules apply to them, and that if they cannot abide by the rules, I am obligated by the terms of my position to send them out of the room so that those people who can abide by the rules can have the opportunity to do their classwork and not wind up with zeros because they are suspended in school during the day. I don't often have to send a student out. I have a few who get sent out on a regular basis because they're so sure that their self-esteem matters more than their self-control because they've been told this all throughout their schooling. Our kids spend 1/3 of their waking hours in classrooms between the ages of 6 and 17. 1/3 of their hours awake is in a classroom with a teacher, sometimes several of them, attempting to share with those children the knowledge that teacher has gained over a lifetime of study and experience. What we have to offer our students is quite valuable. The reason we offer it is because we believe that we are enjoined to provide these kids with enough tools, academic, social, etc., so that they can become adults eventually and don't, hopefully, wind up in a hospital, a jail, or a graveyard, or all three before they're 25. We keep doing it. My friend Linda says she knows the lesson she got about self-control. She only had to learn it about twice. And that's because my friend Linda, as I did, had parents who taught her, not indulged her, not felt sorry for her, not gave her her way so they didn't have to worry about discipline, but who taught her, who had to play tough love. Because children, ladies and gentlemen, are not adults. And the accommodation approach, which is built into the Americans with Disabilities Act before it got applied to education, understood that. Reasonable accommodations for those who were disabled in some form were quite needed so that someone who might not be able to walk yet still had a functioning brain and hands with great knowledge and great expertise would not be barred from competing in the workplace to the level of his or her skills or barred from participating in government because stairs were impossible when it came to going to register to vote or to attend city council meetings or to attend rallies for political candidates. Disabled American adults needed these accommodations, and that key word, reasonable, was written into the law. Obviously, if you are going to have someone who is basically a cashier in a grocery store who talks with and listens to customers all day long, it's unlikely that a person who cannot speak or cannot hear would be able to do this job efficiently. So it would be ridiculous to assume that a person who was deaf and had no vocal cords could be a successful supermarket cashier. And any adult person with those handicaps would know that it was ridiculous to assume that they could do what the job required. They could work in any computer office, especially with the ability to type or artificial voice synthesizers such as Stephen Hawking uses. But as far as being a grocery store clerk, ringing up sales and so on and so forth, no, they couldn't do it. American adults with disabilities weren't attempting to be given whatever job they thought they wanted, whether they could do it or not. They were only asking for the opportunity to show that they could do some jobs. But when the Americans with Disabilities Act got twisted around and applied to public education, it forgot that what you were dealing with was not adults who understood that everyone has limitations. For example, there is no way on this earth that I could be a telephone lineman. I'm an acrophobe. I'm terrified of heights. I can't climb telephone poles or go up in a cherry picker. I would be in an absolute panic with my eyes shut, whiter than a sheet, clinging to the side of the thing and begging somebody to let me down. I am aware of that. So I am not going to say, hey, I have this disability. I'm terrified of heights. You've got to build me a tower and carry it around with you on the truck with an elevator in it so I can do this job. I'm not foolish enough to expect anybody to do that. It's inefficient, it's expensive, and it certainly doesn't make the company do any better or the service to the lines any better. Children do not understand this, ladies and gentlemen. And when you accommodate a child and his appropriate education is, in effect, removing the social obligations of courtesy and respect because, quote-unquote, he can't help being a jerk, then you are creating a mini Frankenstein's monster who will never, until somebody beats the you-know-what out of him, understand that, no, the world is not going to bow to his, quote-unquote, disability as the school does. And when he or she turns 18, they are going to be dumped from the free appropriate education accommodation and disability money and said, okay, now you go find a job. And they have no knowledge that's marketable because somebody has given them a grade or allowed them to empty wastebaskets instead of learning times tables or how to subtract. Yes, their self-esteem is incredibly high. They know that they're wonderful. And they expect you to know that too, whether they can do the job they're trying to get or not. Their simple existence makes them qualified for anything they want. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, we need to revamp the way we deal with students with disabilities. We have to recognize that they are not adults. They are not going to have the life experience or the developed intellectual capacity to understand that sometimes you can't do something. Sometimes you're going to fail. But that doesn't mean you can't do anything. It just means you may need to choose another path. Our federal government, with its meddling in our public schools, has created a climate of students and teachers who are working at odds with each other instead of cooperatively where teaching and learning can take place. You cannot teach, ladies and gentlemen, in a classroom where 20% of the time is spent getting everybody to shut up long enough to listen to what you are saying. And believe me, the school in which I work is excellent. Our band, for example, today went to the district band assessments and came back with a superior rating. They did beautifully because that particular activity requires self-control and self-discipline, and they were taught that in the band classroom. Nobody was given a membership in band to make them feel good. They had to have demonstrated skill and talent on their particular instrument to be a part of it. They earned that superior rating because they put forth the effort, and they should have self-esteem as big as Mount Everest because they earned it, ladies and gentlemen. They deserve to be congratulated and praised and told they're wonderful because they proved it. Not merely by existing or by demanding they be given accommodations and get to join band if they can't carry a tune and are tone deaf, but because they learned to play an instrument and they practiced and practiced until they could play it well. Our public education system needs to re-examine its purpose. It's not about building self-esteem. It's about building educated citizens. An egocentric, look at me, aren't I wonderful voter is the last guy I want punching buttons on the voting machine. Because he will quite readily punch a button for anybody who says, gee, you're wonderful, just vote for me and I'll prove it. There is a difference, ladies and gentlemen, between providing help to a student who has physical, emotional, or mental difficulties that require them to learn in different ways than the average. Reasonable accommodation and appropriate public education don't mean the entire class suffers because one child cannot control himself or herself. My friend Linda says the system is broken. The school systems are broken, and she's correct. It is. Because we are trying to do the impossible. Out of a mistaken sense of compassion, we are attempting to fix stupid, and in the process, neglecting those who aren't. We are bending over backwards to make people who cannot learn feel good about themselves at the expense of those who can. The whole system of collaborative classes and mainstreaming is fatally flawed because it does the opposite of what the liberal Elysian Fields utopian educational theorists think it would do. It doesn't induce compassion in the breasts of the normal and above average kids for the child who has troubles. It doesn't make the child who is less able to learn, feel better and have friends and be comfortable in class. It does the exact opposite. Kids who can learn either ape the behaviors and the disinclination to try of the children whose work is done for them, or they are so frustrated because the class never gets anywhere because the teacher has to explain every point 6 times so that those on the bottom end of the scale will understand it. And yet, in these classes, those same students, both ends of the spectrum, are expected to master the same amount of academic knowledge and skill within a given 9-month school year, and are tested to make sure they've done so. You cannot make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, even with government influence. Trust me. I am not a cruel person, ladies and gentlemen. I am not an elitist who says that there is no good at anybody who doesn't have an IQ over 160, because if I said that, I'd be SOL myself, because I don't have one over 160. But I am a realist, and I understand that when you are educating children, children do not instinctively feel compassion for those who cannot fit into their circle, particularly in the middle school age group. I've worked with middle school children, ladies and gentlemen, for 40 plus years now, both as a private tutor, a substitute teacher, and an in-school suspension coordinator. This age, this critical age, that supposedly prepares children to go to high school and start having everything counting toward graduation, is a herd that follows whatever bellwether looks cool and has the prettiest bell, and turns on any member of the flock who doesn't smell like, look like, sound like, or act like everybody else. This age group is about fitting into a group. There are always the odd, unusual loners. I was one, in that groups have never appealed to me. But I'm an anomaly. I am not the norm, which is fine. The norm is a statistical fiction anyway. Nobody matches it, just like average, again, statistical fiction. But in general, youngsters in the middle school age bracket, from ages 12 to 14, roughly, depending on when what their birthday is and when they start school, are mostly thinking about how to look cool in front of their chosen significant other, how to get other people to pay attention to them and prove they're cool, and what's the latest thing to do so they don't stand out and they can be an individual who looks just like everybody else, which is the middle schooler's definition of individuality. I'm an individual. See, I've got exactly the same kind of ripped jeans on as everybody else in class. They do not think like adults, ladies and gentlemen, and they never will. And you can't apply adult standards of compassion and inclusion and rationality to 12, 13, and 14-year-olds. They don't have the wiring affixed yet to be able to do it. It is a rare middle schooler who actually would attempt, in spite of what they say in the anti-bullying meetings, to include a child who acts or speaks or looks very different from the norm. And it isn't that they are evil or bad. It's just that they are adolescents. And this is part of the age. Collaborative classes may function well in grade school, but beyond that, they do the opposite of their stated purpose, especially in the middle school years. You're not raising the self-esteem of the child who has difficulties when you put him in a classroom with children who do not have difficulties and who are frustrated because they are being held back to match the pace of the kid who can't keep up, or there's a teacher's aide or special education teacher going over the material in a low voice right next to them when they're trying to listen to the teacher. And I know, I've been in that position, both as the teacher and as the aide. I've filled in for special education teachers as a substitute and done it there too. It is not possible in the traditional classroom, which is what 99% of our schools still have, to be able to individualize and present the material to each and every student according to each student's needs, likes, dislikes, temperament, disabilities, or lack thereof. It cannot be done. It is not possible. Not in the real world. In the Borg collective, perhaps. But we, not yet, are we living in the Borg collective, and God forbid we should ever wind up there. I had a student who was working on science, physical science, eighth grade level. And part of the interactive textbook, which is what they're using, it just means it's a workbook and they write answers in it. Fancy name for a, you know, something that's been around since I was in school. But anyway, the section was talking about Sir Isaac Newton's three laws of motion and the fact that they were first published in 1680 and that they are still being taught as the basis of science, physical science, today. And the student was asked on the page to think of a scientific discovery, a current scientific discovery, that students might be learning hundreds of years from now. It took me 30 minutes to get this student to understand that the answer couldn't be Sir Isaac Newton's laws of motion. I am not kidding you. I am not making a joke. 30 minutes to explain why you couldn't list Sir Isaac Newton's three laws of motion as a current scientific discovery that will be taught in hundreds of years. We never did get around to one from his mind because he had no clue what scientific discoveries actually were. The first example was the missing plane, the Malaysia Airlines 777. And then it was, I think it was something like playing basketball. It just, and he couldn't tell me what science was. He had no clue what the subject he was studying was for. Where do you go when you've got a kid who's gone through 8 years, well, 7.5 years of schooling, and doesn't understand that a current discovery doesn't mean something that was published in 1680. And that science is about understanding how the universe and everything in it works. And not understanding the difference between civics and science. And not having any clue what civics was to begin with. And no clue what economics is, either. And yet, ladies and gentlemen, I am expected to be able to, somehow or other, magically wave my wand with a little star on the end, on the top of his head, and transfer my 18 years of schooling and 67 years of life experience into his 13-year-old brain. Oh, how I wish I had that magic wand. Because God love this child. He is a hard row to hoe unless he goes into the family business and somebody does the work and gives him a chair and a suit to wear while they do it. He has spent 7.5 years sitting there absorbing absolutely nothing. Had another student, the one that I kicked out of ISS earlier this week, whose concept of education is, I don't like this, so I don't have to do it. I don't want to. Who never addresses me by my name and title. Who calls me Miss. And every time I say something, he says, what are you talking about? And thinks it's funny to refuse to do an assignment sent to him by his teacher. And yet this particular student supposedly got straight A's on his homeschooling courses before he came to us. 8th grade. And I have some bright ones. Every once in a while. Generally, they don't keep coming back, you know, like a bad Mexican meal. They generally have one time in there because they get caught up in something going on in the class and they get so frustrated that they lose their temper and they can't control themselves. And I can understand it because Lord knows I certainly get frustrated. My friend Jo says she'd hang him on a hook by the back of his shirt. That might help, but then, you know, he's not very decorative, so, you know, my classroom wouldn't look very good. If he were better looking, he might make a good wall hanging. But this system that we've got, ladies and gentlemen, so often creates an atmosphere of anti-learning instead of pro-learning. Because it shows the children who can learn, but who are indifferent to it because they're kids, that, well, so-and-so gets away with it, why shouldn't I? And the poor teachers, they don't have my options. They can't kick the kid out. They write referrals, and the kid's sent to the office, gets ISS or OSS, but he comes right back and does exactly the same things. Because as far as he's concerned, he can do whatever he doggone well pleases and the world has to bow to him for it. I have several like that. Where they don't do the work because it's beneath them, they think. And the parents support this attitude. And rail like crazy at the schools because their kid doesn't know what he's supposed to, and it's got to be our fault. I know some of you out there are thinking, why in the name of heaven does she keep doing it? Okay. Well, partly because I'm a little crazy. You have to be to work with middle schoolers, trust me. And I've been doing it for a very long time. But partly because somebody has to. Somebody has to be willing to put up with this in the hopes that they might get through the cracks and the chinks that are still there with this age group, and that something you teach them or tell them is going to strike that spark that will light a flame, that will let them discover that learning is a positive thing, that it's valuable, and yes, it can be fun. That's another concept that got into our public schools that makes me boil under the collar. This learning is fun credo, which the children translate as, if I'm not having a good time, I don't have to learn this. Believe me, this is the way kids think. They're expecting the nearest amusement park every day in a classroom. Granted, it can be fun. Activities can be done that the children enjoy and from which they learn. But you can't have life like that, ladies and gentlemen. We learn as much from our stumbles and falls as we do from crossing the finish line first. Even more, I think. Well, my friend Linda says, it is when you're three. Uh-huh. And this is exactly what we're telling kids they need to remain. They need to remain a spoiled toddler who, when they hurt themselves, shriek, "Mommy, Mommy, make the bad stove go away," and Mommy immediately replaces it with something that's covered with foam rubber so they can't bump into it. Instead of telling them, "Okay, I told you that was hard. Don't play around it." We are so concerned with their self-esteem and their emotional cotton wadding that we don't give them the resilience they need to deal with the bumps and bruises that life will inevitably give them. We don't teach them how to fight. Ladies and gentlemen, and I don't mean fist fights, I don't mean wrestling matches, I don't mean picking up a gun and shooting people. That's not at all what I mean. Fight is keep going in spite of obstacles. Pin your courage to the sticking place, as Lady Macbeth tells her dear wishy-washy husband. Sometimes you have to fight to get what you want or need. And I don't mean physical altercations, wars, shooting matches. I'm talking about the kind of fight that says, I have had a stroke, but I will keep going until I learn to walk again. Or the kind of fight that says, yes, I've been diagnosed with stage 3 cancer, but I am going to fight to live through chemotherapy and radiation and whatever other means of curing this I can find. That survival instinct, as my friend Linda mentions, requires the ability to fight. You don't succeed and live to adulthood if every time there's an obstacle you turn around and tell somebody else to take it out of the way or lie down and throw a tantrum until somebody says you don't have to climb it. Human beings are proven to be capable of overcoming incredible difficulties. Incredible difficulties. But they can't if they're constantly told they shouldn't have to have any difficulties at all. If they're brought up with the easy button as the one and only resource, how are they going to deal with the disasters that life will hand them? Everything from personal, emotional disasters to actual physical hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, and volcanic eruptions. The age group that I deal with does not have enough life experience at age 12, 13, or 14 to know that they can survive great difficulty. And we are teaching them by the way we accommodate things that they don't have to struggle, that everybody should make life an easy, rosy path to nirvana, comfort, 3 square meals, TV, and a chair that has a potty in it so you don't have to get up and walk to a bathroom. When I have a student who has difficulty with something, I don't tell them they don't have to do it. If I ever do, please call those nice little men with that interesting little jacket that ties your arms behind you, okay, and have me taken away because I will have gone irremediably and certifiably insane. I will and do bend over backwards to rephrase, redefine, re-explain as many times as it takes to help a child understand a concept or a process. But I cannot learn for them. No teacher can. And yet, that is the underlying philosophy that has permeated our public schools, that somehow or other, teachers are expected to learn for their students. They are supposed to have that magic wand that indoctrinates and inoculates the student with knowledge, skill, and understanding, and builds their self-esteem at the same time, without any effort at self-control, or any effort at all on the part of the student. Our kids understand that some things take effort to get better at. Anyone who plays any sport or game knows this, even if it's a video game. They know that the first time they play Call of Duty, they're probably not going to get a world-shattering, world-record high score. So they keep doing it until they get better. But they don't expect to exert this same amount of practice when it comes to learning academic skills. There's a disconnect there, ladies and gentlemen. They're quite capable of understanding if you want to get better at something, you have to do more of it until you understand it and can do it well. Our band's superior rating at the district assessments is evidence of that. The wrestling team, the football team, the softball team. Winning a game. Getting better at being a fielder or a first baseman or a point guard or a quarterback or a lineman or whatever so that you make the team and you keep your slot. They are not incapable of understanding that if you want to get better at something, you've got to freaking practice it. But for some reason, learning, academic learning, doesn't come into that arena. That's some kind of magical osmosis-like process that just so long as they're in the presence of a teacher with a teaching certificate, somehow or other learning happens whether they want it or not. This is why I get so frustrated, ladies and gentlemen, and bless your hearts, you listen to me rant and rave and blow off steam here. And it isn't just for my comfort that I do it. It's because, as our opening theme song for this show says, we all are this nation. It's made up of us and our kids and their children's children. That's what preserves this nation and its heritage of incredible freedom and wealth of spirit as well as dollars. We innovate and create and go out ahead because we have the freedom and opportunity to do so. We put more effort into teaching our children that they have to practice to be better at football than we do in teaching them that if you want to memorize your times tables, you got to look at them more than once. We don't tell them that you are expected to remember that 7 times 9 is 63 on your deathbed. And Common Core, God help us, continues this same nonsense. It's not passing the test and then dump it. You cannot teach children, I don't need to know that if it's not on a test, and expect them to learn enough to be able to function in life. My friend Linda said that our mom's housekeeper heard part of the show and asked my friend Linda if this was a classroom. Well, maybe it sounds like one because just about anywhere I am turns into one. So my apologies to the nice lady. I'm not trying to be her teacher. I'm trying to be her mentor. And teachers can be that. Maravilloso. Dígase a ella, buenos días y muchísimas gracias para escuchando. Tell her, hi there, and thanks a lot for listening. My students, I had one today who, when I was talking about the different types of paintings, what the difference was between a cityscape, a landscape, and a portrait, and I used as an example of a cityscape, El Greco's Vista de Toledo, which translates to View of Toledo, or Toledo, Spain. The kid went off into incredible giggles at hearing a foreign language. And I jumped down his throat, and I said, do you know how rude that is? Someday, somebody's going to pop you one in the mouth if they're speaking their native language and you start giggling at it. No self-control. Absolutely none. Now, please, Linda, when you see her again, please convey my good wishes, and I hope that she has a chance to listen in. And she's kind of stuck with me being a teacher. I can't help it. But this is part and parcel of the self-esteem over self-control. The mantra that says the function of an education is to make you feel good about yourself. No, it's not. The function of an education is to give you knowledge, which then allows you to feel good about yourself. Our kids are being cheated by our public schools, ladies and gentlemen, every single minute they're there. And I can tell you for a fact, it isn't teachers that are doing the cheating. In spite of the demonization of the teachers' union, which they deserve, by the way, because their interest is not in the progress of children, no matter what the heads of the union say. Their interest is in securing job security for the members of their union and political power with the money those union members pay. They don't give a rat's backside for the kids their members teach. Their function as a union is their members, not the children. A union doesn't represent the machine on which you work or the patient with whom you interact or the child you teach. The union's job is to represent the interests of the teachers, which, like all of us, is in keeping one's job and being paid commensurate with one's skills, abilities, and learning. That's why the current trend of let's evaluate the teachers and find out who's a good one and who's a bad one, and use the test scores of their students as the means of evaluation, is ridiculous, especially with the collaborative mainstreaming system going on. All that does is encourage teachers to give students the answers for fear they're going to get fired if everybody doesn't get a C or better. And you don't get honest grades that actually measure the student's progress and ability to continue on beyond today's work. There is a self-esteem issue wrapped up in this too. Too many parents see a grade not as a measure of what their child has learned, but as a measure of what they and their child are worth, like a dollar sign or a price tag. My friend Linda says, my God, not only dealing with the kids, then teach to the test, then being evaluated on your skills. Yikes. Uh-huh. Is it any wonder that so many teachers who go into the profession full of idealism and the joy of imparting knowledge get the heck out of it after less than 5 years? Yeah, well, this is, sounds like a hostile work environment. Yeah, you could say that. And believe me, the blame the teacher game goes on and on. Granted, there are bad teachers. There are teachers who don't give a rat's behind whether the kids in their classes learn anything so long as they have a job. There are people like that in every profession. It isn't unique to education. You've all, every single one of you out there listening, and everybody in this chat room, has worked for people or with people who are like that. The ones who don't care whether the job gets done, just so long as they aren't blamed for the failure. And who spend more time trying to keep a job than they do in actually doing the job. I don't know of a profession or a career that doesn't have people like that. But in the private sector, those people generally succumb to the Peter principle. Promoting and promoting and promoting until you reach a level of incompetence. But public education doesn't do that because there is no free market penalty for a bad job. We are the only provider, ladies and gentlemen, for the vast majority of American children. We are a monopoly. The wealthy have always sent their children to private schools. That's not a phenomenon unique to the 21st century. It's been going on since the colonies, for heaven's sake. And if you can afford to send your child to an excellent school where he or she will get an excellent education, this is a free country. You go right ahead. If you can give them those advantages, good for you and good for them. But the rest of us, who can't afford $5,000 a year tuition for grade school, middle school, and high school, look to our public education system as a viable alternative. And unfortunately, it's not. And the irony is that we are paying tuition, ladies and gentlemen. With every penny that's taken out of our paycheck in taxes, the taxes we pay when we purchase something, whether it's gasoline or groceries or medicines or a house or telephone service or cell phone service or satellite service or the internet or anything else we buy. Our real estate taxes, our personal property taxes, our income taxes to the federal government and to the state government. We are paying tuition, ladies and gentlemen, and we are getting jack in return. Because education is about self-esteem instead of self-control. And it's not just the kids. It's the parents and the administrators and some of the teachers as well. It's the idea that has permeated our society that everybody owes me something because I'm here. I did not grow up with that philosophy, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm guessing that a great many of you didn't either. My friend Linda reminds me of my analogy, a large group of broken washing machines with stacks and stacks of flat currency stuffed into them, and that's just about it. All the money that we spend and are taxed for the purposes of spending on our public education system, buys us uneducated, spoiled brats who vote for anybody who promises to make their life easy, and guarantee that they'll never have to work for anything as long as they live. Because it will be taken away from somebody who has worked and given to them. Because that's fair. No, it's not. Even the everybody gets a trophy dies the death by the time you get to high school. And it's a brutal, bruising collision when the kids who've been told over and over again that everybody should get a trophy discover that it's not going to happen after about fifth, sixth, or seventh grade. We are supposed to be preparing our children for life, ladies and gentlemen, all of us. Not just teachers, not just parents, but every adult who interacts with any child. We have to exhibit the kind of self-control we wish them to have. And I can promise you, ladies and gentlemen, that mine is stretched to the limit at least 3 out of the 5 days a week of school. If I were not an adult, if I did not have self-control, it would be very easy to explode into, if not profanity, then scathing remarks on the abilities of the children I am asked to help. And I don't just mean their academic abilities. But I am an adult. And I have learned self-control in the hard school of growing up. And there are still times when I lose it. I haven't reached the pinnacle of wise sage who never ever loses control yet. I probably will never get there because I am passionate about way too many things. But I understand that about myself, I accept it about myself, and I hold a tight rein on my self-control because I know that simply being here does not make me perfect, does not entitle me to ride roughshod over others simply because I'm here, and that my self-esteem is not based on I deserve it because I'm me. It's based on, did I do a good job and did I put 100% of my effort into the doing of it? And if I can tell myself yes on both those counts, then I can feel good about myself. Our kids need to learn this. And they need to learn this from us. By precept and by example. We have to show them that from self-control grows self-esteem. That self-esteem is earned, not given. And that it's hard to earn it. Because anything worth having takes effort to get. We need to corner our representatives from the local school board to the White House and require that they too exert self-control and be adults, not wishful thinking. Not anti-realism, pie in the sky, peace on earth, goodwill to men through legislative action or executive order, but through understanding that human beings are not perfect and they are not perfectible, but that the opportunity to grow must be available to all. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the founding principle of this nation. That wonderful world word, opportunity, a chance to succeed on your own merits, without artificially being lifted up or artificially being held down on the basis of sex, ethnic origin, race, academic skills, intelligence, or any other factor, to be given the chance to try. That's why we had a flood of immigrants in the early 20th century, and why we have a flood of them now. Not necessarily legally entering, but they're coming here for the same thing. A chance to succeed. My friend Rod says the value of something is placed there by how much you paid for it or the amount of effort to get it, and that is correct. Value is not an absolute. It is a relative. Dirt has no value. All it takes is walking outside and sticking your foot in it, and you've got dirt. We're telling our children that self-esteem is dirt. I don't believe that. I've never believed it. My self-esteem, if you will, is built more on the mistakes I've made and overcome than it is on my easy successes. Yes, I got straight A's in Spanish all the way through college. Not because it was hard for me, but because it was easy. That doesn't boost my self-esteem. It's just something that I was born with, an ability for languages. I can't be proud of it because I didn't do anything to gain it. I just did the work, okay, and listened and practiced and improved a skill that I was born with, a talent that I had. I was prouder, way prouder, of figuring out how to change the water filter in my house than I ever was of an AM Spanish class. Because changing that water filter when I didn't know what the heck I was doing and was scared I was going to flood the utility room, and I did it, and I didn't flood the utility room, now I can pat myself on the back. My friend Rod says I took the time to learn it, and that's a cost, my time, and it does place value on it. Yes, it does. I don't undervalue the ability to speak Spanish, but I don't promote, it doesn't promote my self-esteem that I did learn it because it was easy for me. Learning how to do algebraic equations, yeah, that boosts my self-esteem because I had no clue what they were talking about, and I had to teach it to myself. And that I'm proud of, because I don't like math. But I did it, and now I can teach it. The value of a thing is directly proportional to the amount of effort or cost you incur in getting it. You're going to take way better care of a $2 million Van Gogh painting than you are of a picture out of a magazine that you found in a dumpster. My friend Rod says he places no value on speaking Spanish because he has no need of it, so he never learned it or spent the time. And that's exactly true. Value of a thing differs from person to person. That's why I say it's subjective. It's not an absolute. It's relative. The things that are valuable to me because they mean something to me personally, either that they're useful or beautiful or they have associations with positive thoughts, would not be valuable to somebody else. The value of a thing is directly related to how much effort we put into getting it. I remember a story that my mother used to tell. She and her sister, my aunt, grew up very poor. Their father died when my mother was 10, and my aunt was 15. My grandmother had a 6th or 7th grade education, and she was left a widow. My grandfather had no life insurance, so she and my mother and my aunt had to live with relatives and were basically looked down their nose at and treated like dirt because they weren't rich, and suffered to allowed to live in the basement apartment of a relative's house at minimal rent. Not for free, mind you, but at minimal rent. And my mother didn't have all of the toys and things that her cousins had, because they weren't in the straitened economic circumstances that my mom and her mother and her sister were. But my mother did have a tricycle that she called Gray Mouse, and she loved that little bike. And her cousins came to visit. And the cousin that was closest to her in age decided to ride the tricycle off the road, into a ditch, bang it up, bend the wheel so that it was no longer useful, and laugh about her accident. Because if she did that to her tricycle, her parents could buy a new one. But my mother's mother, my grandmother, couldn't. My mother never forgave that cousin. Never. Mother was very good at holding grudges. But I understand why. Something that seemed of less value than a rock to her wealthier and better provided for cousin meant the world to my mother. And its destruction, its careless destruction, gave her a lifelong scar. Little gray tricycle to my mother was the equivalent of a Mercedes-Benz hot off the assembly line, custom designed for her. She took care of it because she knew she wasn't going to get a new one at the drop of a hat. It had value because it took effort for her mother to be able to get that for her. And my mother knew that she could not have another one if she didn't treat it well. We take care of those things upon which we place high value, ladies and gentlemen. Our children, our home, a special piece of art, jewelry, clothing, a memento of a happy time or a loved person. Their value on the open market is not what we care about so much as it is the amount of effort we put into to get them, or the associations they have for us from life events and relationships. We are telling our children in our current educational system that knowledge has no value. Only tests do. Grades do. And that saddens me. Have a caller. Hang on. Let's see who's on the line. Hello there.
It's that California bird of paradise, the conservative from the libtard state of California. Hi.
With her beautiful plumage spread, I'm sure. Hi, Linda. How is life in the in La La Land?
Yes. Well, now I didn't get all the details because there is a. No, your skills would be great because the lady who does our house does speak fluent Spanish, because it's her heritage, and her daughters are completely bilingual. They're pretty cool.
Wow.
But she was trying to explain to me that the I think the oldest one had 3 or 4 days in a row of between 3 and 4 hours of state testing, and these kids, I don't know if she's in high school, and if she is, she's not no more than a sophomore. I don't know what the hell is going on, so I got to find out more when I see her again and find out what it was, because it sounds ominous to me. We never went through that. I mean, not 3 and 4 days in a row.
No, but that they do now. Here in Virginia,
oh my God.
Our standards, our standards of learning tests, which are abbreviated in EduSpeak as SOL for obvious reasons, our kids get tested every year, usually in May, in the four core areas. The way Virginia does it, they always get tested in language skills and mathematics, and they alternate years for social studies and science. So one year they'll have math, language skills, and science. The next year it'll be math, language skills, and social studies. So basically they're being tested every other year and on expected to remember 2 years worth of study. And those SOL tests figure into their placement in the next year's classes. For example, for our eighth graders to be able to take a foreign language that gives them high school credit in eighth grade, they have to score high on their English SOLs, which makes sense because if they understand the construction of the English language, they will be able to learn another one because they'll know what a verb is. At least we assume they will, but half of them don't because I've taught that class. How in the name of heaven they pass the SOLs without knowing what a verb is, I still don't understand, but they did, or at least sufficiently, or had parental pull enough to get the class because mommy wanted them to. That's what the state does.
You know, it's good that you're speaking on these things because the schools, you must be batting your head against the wall because if they're not placing value on actual education and knowledge, then of course they're never going to be able to think for themselves critically or outside of the box. And I do believe that the ones behind all of this, the real progressives, and I call them the American left, don't want them to think. They want them to be sheeple and punch the ballot box, for the ones who are going to give them the handouts and keep them in the box or Plato's cave. It's very sad. And when you talk about the children in your age group and the ones below that, and of course even infants, et cetera, that's where it starts in the home, the parents. I mean, all education should start at the feet of the moms, I think, and go from there. And the self-esteem stuff, I mean, you can teach kids the value of things and the value of like you say, the tricycle, of course. But you can teach them the value of their own self-esteem by the rewards that you give them, whether it's an allowance for doing a great job of keeping your room clean. And then they're going to feel good about themselves. It's that entrepreneur.
Because
that thing that we talked about with the trade school stuff and the the apprenticeship stuff. They've felt it. They've done it. It's hands on, and it's a shame that our schools are not doing that for these kids at every level. I don't care if they're 6 years old or they're 16. They should be on field trips once a year and experiencing life. Even if it's only for a couple of hours and having some guy at the back end of the McDonald's saying, well, this is how you do this and this is how you work your way up, and let them see it in real life and see the kids getting a paycheck. I mean, there's got to be a way to, because they are limited in scope. They have small worlds. They don't have the experience. But
they don't.
You can teach them. You can give them a taste of it. So.
Yeah, I remember when I was in grade school, my Girl Scout troop had a trip to the city jail. And we were shown how fingerprints were taken in those days. They didn't have a scanner.
Wow.
You got ink on your fingers.
Yeah.
We were shown the cells. The police officers talked to us and explained the process of being arrested and what you went through and what bail was and so on and so forth. We were fifth grade.
Wow.
Fifth grade. But we were exposed to real life. One of the kids I had in my ISS room today, I swear to God, Linda, that kid is going to wind up in jail simply because he has no clue what the law is. Understanding that the reason you learn about civics and the judicial system, he asked me, are they going to tell us all this when we graduate? Yeah.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. And this is what I deal with. This is what we all of us in the profession deal with. This kid has been passed through eight freaking grades.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sorry, but I would have more
failure.
Luck. I would have more luck teaching a box of rocks Euclidean geometry than teaching this kid anything.
That's a shame. And you know what? There's failure of the system. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
There's no
exactly.
reason for that, especially mm-hmm. if the child is not mildly retarded in any way. This is, you know what I'm saying? You could
yeah,
understand if they were had cerebral palsy or Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
but
this kid doesn't.
There's no excuse for this. Yeah.
And he's not even in the special ed system.
Yeah. See, that's what I'm saying. That's just, to me, incomprehensible. I don't understand it.
Yeah. I don't understand how anybody can enjoy being that ignorant.
Well,
the
sad part is he will find out how much fun it is not to have, you know,
yeah.
critical thinking when he's doing
uh-huh.
that fingerprint.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely no clue that... that you don't get arrested because you're guilty. You get arrested because somebody thinks you are.
Right. Oh, my
God. He has no understanding of how that works. I don't know whether
right.
his parents ever talk with him or he never watches anything except, you know, cartoons and plays video games. But, good
I mean,
Lord.
You can almost even learn that by watching Law and Order, for heaven's sake.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Wow. But, and that's not the greatest example.
No, but
I mean,
at least you have a glimmer
oh
of understanding
God.
About how the system works. But
man,
these
that
kids,
is,
you know, the idea
that
is
a
asking
sad case,
me,
yeah.
are they going to tell me this all of this when I graduate? No, dear, you're supposed to know it by the time you graduate. Well, I don't remember stuff. Yeah. And we don't train children anymore in memorization skills. We used to.
I know.
Remember, every week or every 2 weeks, you had to stand up and recite something. I
yes.
did.
And when I was in high school, and you know, I think I was a freshman, and I loved the theater because I got that from my dad. So,
yeah, I did too.
And so when I took my drama classes, yeah, he was a thespian and a teacher, and I think one of his dreams was to be a movie star in Hollywood, but he knew he couldn't do that and try to starve on the way. Especially mm-hmm. with wife and two kids and making us starve to death while he's, yeah. Anyway, so, mm-hmm. But we would do community theater, you know, all those things. Well, just lost my train of thought. As far as the soliloquies, and we talked about the Shakespeare before, well, that's memorization. When you take dance lessons and you want to master the art of ballet, you had better learn how to memorize because you
mm-hmm.
have to do 10 things at once, number one, just to do a plié. I mean, that's pretty bad. That's like golf,
mm-hmm.
you know. The skills are inbred in you. You know, if you have good training, and I was very fortunate to have the parents that I do, and the teacher when I was 22, 23, and he was originally from Cuba, and he was
mm-hmm.
he learned the art of, and some of these were Zen, some of them were, you know, just taught in other countries, of the
mm-hmm.
memorization. But not just to do it by rote, but to hone your skills as to be how fast can you memorize it and how well can you, like, retain it for life. I mean,
exactly.
amazing stuff. And he taught that stuff to us. And I was
mm-hmm.
still quite young. I was 23, 24. And once you get that, you never lose it. And it's quite a great advantage. I mean, it's amazing.
Just look at something as simple as memorizing your times tables. And the reason that kids
yeah.
run screaming in horror when they see a fraction, because you can't just poke a button on a calculator to do fraction, addition,
yeah.
and subtraction. This is what
sure.
they're used to doing. You know, I know that 6 plus 7 equals 13, because if I put a 6 and then a plus sign and then a 7 and hit equals, 13 pops up.
Oh, my God.
Not because I remember
yeah.
that 6 things plus 7
right.
things makes 13 things, so therefore 13
and
things, if you take away the 7, you're left with 6. That goes past
right.
them with, you know, no clue.
I know. In the old way, when we literally had pieces of paper and you had your little lines and you
uh-huh.
you put your 7 and you put the 6 under it and you put the line and then you had your plus sign at the side, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would not only memorize it, but you could do it by just the groups of tens mm-hmm. if you're feeling naturally or if you're good
uh-huh.
with an abacus. But I mean, you know, that's how you do it.
Well,
And
just the understanding of how our decimal system of numeration works, that every place
right.
value is multiplied by 10. You go from tens
right.
to hundreds to thousands, et cetera. I had a kid in there today who was doing or trying to do scientific notation, and, oh, my God, was that a struggle. which is, you know, like 3,000, 3,000 is 3 times 10 to the third power.
Right.
Scientific notation was used for astronomical numbers, like the distance between planets or the distance between galaxies.
Right.
Oh, my Lord, I spent an hour.
Oh, you, yeah. Well, you know, when, I know, when you have those calculators and those cheat sheets like that, it's really a disservice. Because
yes.
When you have that white paper and you're doing it yourself, and once it's there, it's not only imprinted on that page, it actually imprints on your memory scan in your brain.
Exactly.
That's how I learned how to read and how to do math, et cetera. That it did, and I'm very fortunate with that.
It is understood by any educational professional that the more of your senses you can engage in a learning experience, the more likely you are to remember the stuff. That's why writing stuff down, writing timetables, boring as it is. When I used to tutor, all of my kids tried to do the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then 7, 7, 7, 7, and then all the answers. I wouldn't let them because you don't remember that 7 times 9 is 63 that way. You got to write the whole cotton-picking list to figure it out. I would not allow them to do times tables that way. I would stand over them and make out 1 times 7 equals 7, 2 times 7 equals 14 across every single line. And if they tried to do the shortcut, I'd take it away, tear up the paper, and make them do it over again.
Ooh, wow.
And they,
good for you.
I'm an evil, nasty old witch, Linda, you know. And, you know, the kids still say, you know, I like it here in ISS because I learn things.
Thank God. Oh, praise the Lord for that. And I'm going to let you wrap it up because I know you're running out of time. But thanks for taking the call, and it was a great show today. And I'm glad my housekeeper was absolutely glued to my thing, you know, to hear you. So it was great.
I wanted to tell you, too, that one of my close friends here in Virginia, his brother lives in California, and he was visiting and had to leave and wasn't able to be here because I had told him, come by the house and you can get on and help me co-host the show. He and his friends listen in their part of California to this show.
Awesome. Fabulous.
So you're not alone,
baby.
You're not alone.
All right, love. Take care, honey. God bless.
You, too. Thank you for calling, sweetheart.
Okay.
As always, you are a welcome visitor. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend Linda, bless her heart, teaches by example. She doesn't sit back and wait for somebody else to make the changes that need to be made so that every person in this nation can have the kind of opportunity that our founders envisioned. She is my heroine because she puts her money where her mouth is. She's out there standing on street corners. She's out there haranguing people and getting them to listen and learn and find out for yourself. Read this. I'm not making it up. This is history. This has happened. This is what's going on. And she doesn't do it because somebody will artificially give her self-esteem and a pat on the back. She's more likely to get a tomato in the back, for heaven's sake, doing it in California where she lives. But she does know how to fight, ladies and gentlemen. She does know how to see an obstacle as something to get past whatever way she can with integrity and honor and not a reason to lie down and stamp. Somebody removes it. Thank you so much, everybody, for being here tonight. I want you all to know how much I appreciate your support and the fact that you listen to my ranting and raving. I do it for you and for your children and your children's children, ladies and gentlemen, not because I'm wise or famous or rich or more important than anybody else, but because I see things that I believe are a danger to our future. And I want you to see them too, because we are not alone. We have each other. Join me here for Patriot Education next Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Visit our website, www.patriotfamilies.com, and see the links to our other shows. You are the nation, ladies and gentlemen, and you matter. And I look forward to seeing you and talking with you and hearing you next week, same time, same station. And as always, all my love to my greatest fan. Have a wonderful evening, everybody, and blessed be. Good night.